Chapter 81, The Death of Captain Bligh. I was running short of cigarettes, and W. Twiggs, the tobacconist's shop, was having a half day, so I rushed up Gower Street and just managed to catch Mr. T before he turned the open sign round in the front window. Sidney Grice was coming down the stairs as I unclipped my cloak and hung it up.
"You have been running."
He aimed an accusatory finger. It did not take a detective to observe that I was still out of breath.
"Ladies never run."
"Not even if they are being chased?" I unpinned my bonnet.
"Ladies are never chased."
"Perhaps you should tell the gentleman that," I suggested. Molly came dragging a bucket and smearing the floor with a string mop.
"Oh, miss,"
she slopped dirty water over my boots.
"I could have helped you with that."
Molly grasped my hat with soap-suddy hands, crushing the silk marigolds on the side, and rammed it back on my head.
"No,"
I started to explain, but Molly was saying,
"There you are, sir,"
and she handed her employer a stick.
"Is that the one that turns into a stepping ladderer?"
"Leave my things alone."
Mr. G snatched it from her.
"What? All your things, sir?"
Molly grinned dreamily.
"What? Not touch your cups and saucers, your food plates, your dusty furniture and screwed-up newspapers? Oh!"
She clasped her hands ecstatically.
"What a life of bridal pleasure I shall have."
Her face fell.
"Only I don't not much like pleasure. Much."
"I do not think you will be overburdened with it in the near future," I forecast, as Sidney Grice's expression changed from grumpy to very grumpy. I gave up trying to uncrease the orange petals.
"Oh!"
Molly flung my cloak into my arms.
"I don't not know if you remember, miss."
She selected another walking stick, but her employer whipped it away.
"'Cause your remembery ain't not much good,"
Molly went on.
"But when I said I'd had swallowed a live mouse—"
She slapped her bosom so hard that I winced.
"I couldn't not have, could I?"
She cackled, grabbing Mr. G's hat off the stand so violently that she dented the crown.
"Silly me!"
"Well, it is not very likely." I checked my hair in the mirror and decided it did not look too bad by my standards today. I had pinned it up a bit higher and thought it suited me.
"No," she cackled, "'cause cook explainered it. A mouse is much too small to swallow. It must have been a rat."
"At last, a brain inside you."
Sidney Grice inspected his cane suspiciously.
"What brain, sir?"
Molly put a hand up to try to hide the damage. He sighed.
"The rat."
"Oh, no, sir,"
Molly explained patiently.
"It was me who swallowed it, not Miss Middleton."
She made a grab for another stick, and he slapped her hand away. "Tea, please, Molly," I said, before it occurred to her to slap him back. Molly scowled because she had been enjoying the game, and my guardian scowled because I had said please.
"Somebody has been polishing my canes,"
he announced icily.
"That was Miss Middleton, sir,"
Molly put in quickly.
"I tried to stop her. I begged on blended knees."
"Humph,"
Mr. G grumbled. And I took the blame because she would have been in much bigger trouble than I, though I could not help but conjecture that Molly had not just swallowed a rat, she had become one. I had my first cup of tea wordlessly, while Sidney Grice made some urgent notes at his desk, then sorted through the rest of his mail, ripping and screwing up and hurling almost all of it away until, with a loud
"rrr,"
he threw himself into his chair. I poured his drink and topped up mine.
"I was just thinking."
"Nobody just thinks."
He stirred his tea vigorously.
"They do at least 43 other significant things simultaneously. Shall I enumerate?"
"No." I tickled Spirit's ear as she promenaded past me. "I was just thinking how fortunate it is, and I am not sure that it can just be good luck, that none of the women who were violated is with child." Mr. G stopped stirring.
"Not one,"
he agreed carefully. I would not have thought he would be considerate enough to use French.
"Indeed,"
my guardian interrupted, still capable of being shocked at the things I knew. He leaned back, untouched tea swirling around the handle of his spoon,
while he braced himself for what he was about to articulate.
"Come now, March," he chivied. "Finish your sentence. You cannot afford to be priggish in cases like these."
"Letters," I said, and he harumphed.
"Quite so."
And I had a strange feeling that in one field, at least, I might be less squeamish than he.
"Expound 12 major causes of women not conceiving during Congress."
He took an avid interest in his watch. "The woman may be too young or too old," I began. "She may be infertile. It is believed that women are more fecund at certain times of the month." My guardian looked as if the milk he never consumed was sour, but I continued. "She may already be with child, or only just have had one. She may be congenitally barren, or have had an infection."
"We do not need to dwell on the nature of that,"
he assured me hastily. "How many is that?" I asked.
8.
"Is that all?" I racked my brains and remembered that, despite what men like to believe, it was not always the woman's fault. "The man may have had an infection, such as mumps, or be congenitally barren. He may be incapable of..." I struggled to find the right words. "Spilling his seed."
"One more."
Sidney Grice looked distinctly green. "He may have no seed to spill," I ended, to his undisguised relief.
"Let us consider that last proposal first."
He stretched forward to paddle his tea again, 6 times in each direction.
"Since you are invariably slow to say something relevant, why would a man have no seed?"
"He could be a eunuch in a harem," I suggested weakly, "or a castrato in the Sistine Chapel, or have had an accident, or sometimes men are castrated for medical reasons." Sidney Grice rose like a man in a dream, and sleepwalked round his desk to his cabinets. He pulled open a top drawer and plunged his hand in, apparently randomly, like a child at a lucky dip, but withdrawing the file he sought in his first attempt.
"We simply must," he declared, raising the brown envelope high above his head, "and we must do it now."
He waved the envelope triumphantly.
"Pay a visit to Captain Bligh."
"I have some bad news for you." I put down my cup. "Captain Bligh is dead."
"What?"
Sidney Grice slapped the file down onto his desk.
"Dead? Do not tell me he is dead, although you have already done so. Dead when, where and how and why was I not informed?"
"I think about 70 years ago," I hazarded. "I do not know what he died of, but I thought everybody knew." Sidney Grice clapped a hand to his head.
"You must have been mixing with Molly too long to have become so obtuse," he said kindly, "to imagine even for one dull-witted moment that I was referring to Captain, later Vice-Admiral, of the Blue, William Bligh, F.R.S., R.N., who died, incidentally, on Sunday the 7th of December, 1817, sorely missed, though not, I suspect, by the naughty crew members of His Majesty's armed vessel, Bounty."
He threw himself back in his chair.
"I am, of course, and you will feel almost as stupid as you are when I rectify your misunderstanding, referring to Mr. Captain Bligh, the retired general surgeon of Great Russell Street."
"Why was he called that?"
"It is his patronym."
"You know full well what I mean."
"His father was Mr. Bligh, and a great admirer of his namesake."
"I see." I got up, hoping that George would not want to call our firstborn Ounces, though I could just about live with Sterling. Sidney Grice clinked his cup with the spoon as if about to make a speech.
"I cannot possibly drink that now," he complained. "It is grossly overstirred."
And while he rang 3 times for his flask, I got up and glanced at his urgent notes. He had sketched a pole with alternating bars hinging out of the sides. "The Grice Ladder Cane" was printed underneath.